Hello, everybody. This is Doug with Emotional Fair Journey, and I'm here again with David Fetter. How are you doing today, David?
Doing great. It's good to be here.
Good, good. Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this with us. So we're going to do something a little bit different today, David. We got some questions from some blog readers that sent over via email and thought we'd switch it up a bit and talk a little bit about some of the issues that some people are struggling with out there, real life stuff. So I thought I'd just throw the questions out at you and we'll talk about them and you know, get some of your professional advice on some of these things.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Without further ado, the first one's pretty long, so bear with me here. But I do want to read the whole thing since this person took the time to send it in. So here we go. When dealing with a wayward spouse that can't or won't make a firm decision between the betrayed spouse and the affair partner, how long is a reasonable amount of time to give them to sort through their brain to come to a decision on their own? I have told my wayward spouse that he has three options. One is her, and that entails losing me moving out with the kids and cutting ties on our friendship, at least at first, while I move on from our relationship. Second option is me, and that means we try to rebuild our relationship, which requires us working on our communication, and then he loses her, and one of them would have to get a new job, which I assume they must work together, or just because it is a possibility. Not sure what that means. And three, neither of us. And I still move out with the kids. And I've told him that the situation is painful and hard for me to endure, knowing he goes and sees her and is choosing to see what's there with her while feeling like he and I will come back together in the future. And because of how hurtful it is, I would like him to make a decision that he's confident in, but there is an expiration date. I sometimes feel like staying, living in the house is the better option because it will probably help end the relationship, but it's so hard to do, especially when I feel like moving out might be what it takes to wake him up. I keep feeling like my date to have this resolved or move out keeps changing. Originally, I felt like I could wait until the end of May 2020. Now I'm feeling like the end of this year, and I'm feeling like that may change again in my mind with the anger I'm starting to feel about the situation. Okay. I think there's a few things going on there, but I guess going to the main part of the question is, what do you feel is sufficient enough time to give the involved person time to figure themselves out and figure out who they want to be with? How do we approach this?
Yeah. I guess my immediate reaction is that I don't believe there's been any research, or at least I haven't come across any research that would specify how much time should be given. And you know, really the way I approach that is basically to say that the decision of how much time is given needs to be decided by the hurt partner. And the decision, I mean, there are multiple factors that go into it, and that's why I would add that, you know, it's made by the decision of how long is should be given to the wayward spouse, as this person refers to that person, or the involved partner. It's a decision that needs to be made by the hurt partner and needs to be made on a case-by-case basis. That's, you know, to a large part based on the hurt partner's tolerance level, personality, and what is going on. Because, you know, the decision and quite often, actually, I would say that the decision to end an affair is a complicated decision. It's not always as simple as just make a decision and you have, you know, a month to make that decision or 2 weeks to make that decision. I would approach it a little differently. And, you know, certainly one of the things that strikes me about this particular person who wrote this is you know, it brings up the issue of boundaries. And, you know, I'm completely supportive of establishing for the hurt partner to establish healthy boundaries and consequences, because these boundaries define how the hurt partner expects to be treated by the involved partner and how the hurt partner will treat the involved partner. So it goes both ways. The concern for this particular hurt partner is that she herself, I believe it's a female, but anyway,
yes,
this person, she seems herself to be quite ambivalent about following through with the consequences. And that's, you know, what tells me that is that the deadline keeps changing.
Right.
And when that happens, it's doubtful or more problematic, because it's doubtful that the involved partner will take the hurt partner seriously. So when there's ambivalence in the hurt partner, the likelihood of the situation just going on is greater. So first I would say that the hurt partner, this particular person, should get some professional help to resolve the ambivalence that seems to be present in her. Because there's no point in saying, you know, make a choice, you have until whenever, but make a choice, and these are the consequences if that person isn't going to follow through.
Right.
But going back to the other part of the question in terms of how long should be given, I think something that this person may want to consider is what I would call a non-negotiable boundary. So it's not something that is discussed with the involved partner, but stated by the hurt partner, and that is that that the involved partner, she would like the involved partner to be in counseling himself to help him figure out what he's going to do.
Good idea.
Yeah, because otherwise, you know, these situations can go on for quite a while. And,
yeah.
You know, my expectation is that the involved partner won't be able to figure out what they want or why they had the affair on their own. And if they're not in counseling to help them figure that out, then what may evolve is a situation referred to or called stable ambiguity, where where the involved partner is able to have both the committed relationship as well as the affair, which ultimately, depending on how you look at it, is an emotionally abusive situation of the hurt partner. So if the hurt partner would say, I can't force you to go, but my non-negotiable boundary is that you need to be getting some help to figure this out. And if the involved partner refuses to go, then go for counseling to figure it out, then I would suggest that the hurt partner at that point needs to, might want to consider rather whether they should be in this relationship or not. So,
right.
It's not only setting a boundary and say make a decision, but it's also, or how much time to give, it's how that time is going to be used. The other point that I want to make is that another reason situations like these continue for quite some time, and why there's a need for counseling for both the involved partner and the hurt partner, is to understand, with respect to the involved partner, why that person, the involved partner, is having so much difficulty making a commitment to the hurt partner, and for the hurt partner to understand why they're staying in a relationship where there's a lack of commitment. So it's not all just on the involved partner, or the focus should not just be on the involved partner. For example, there's another, you know, issue that often comes up in these cases, and that is when there is this lack of commitment and a person wants to be in between two relationships, the affair and the committed relationship, it's quite possible that the involved partner might be a love avoidant in terms of their attachment style, which is critical to know because, you know, some types of some people who are love avoidant are love avoidant because of earlier trauma in their life. So it's, you know, what I've learned over the years is that, you know, and I was just telling a client of mine this morning that when people betray, I mean, sometimes it's for, you know, maybe more simplistic reasons, such as they can or they have an opportunity and they go for it or things like that. But it could also be much more involved than that, such as earlier trauma, life experiences, attachment styles, and things of that nature. And that, not knowing that, is often a reason why situations like these go on for quite some time, and hence the importance of getting some help for it.
Yeah. Yeah, us lay people call, I can't remember what you just said, something ambiguity.
Is it stable ambiguity?
Stable, yeah, we call it fence sitting. And see it quite a bit. I talk to a lot of people whose spouses are fence sitting, and it seems that, at least what I've experienced, is that sometimes being on top of that fence is a pretty comfortable place for these people. And, you know, they only kind of give attention or kind of move on one side of the fence or the other, depending on, you know, when and if they need to. But yet, you know, they kind of just never make a decision or don't want to make a decision unless they're absolutely forced to or they're motivated in some fashion. So I think we're kind of saying the same type of thing, just a different way. But, you know, I think I agree. I think that she needs to, you know, set some sort of firm deadline on the boundaries or whatever. I do like the boundaries that she said. I mean, she's mm-hmm. she's willing to give the three different options mm-hmm. to him. So that's good. One other thing that, and this is kind
but,
of...
But just on that note, though, that but a boundary, however good it is, a boundary where the person is ambivalent and not necessarily going to follow through, but, you know, change the, you know, where the line is drawn in the sand, is basically giving the message to the other person that they don't have to take the boundary seriously. I have a gentleman that I'm working with who told me that, you know, he drew a line in the sand August of 2018. And, you know, now we're, you know, mm-hmm. mid-September of 2019. And, you know, there are so many lines in the sand that, you know, they just don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah.
With respect to the, you know, the fence sitting, I think that you're right. I mean, I think that sometimes people need to be given, you know, a very clear boundary and know that their partner's going to follow through with it so that they can lean one way and, you know, sort of get off the fence and get into one side of the, you know, one side of or the other. But sometimes there is a real problem in that some people feel, for example, if you have a person who feels that life at home, very domestic, a lot of chores, responsibility, and they fulfill that, but there's a part of them that also wants passion and desire, and they don't see a way to have that in the committed relationship, and they feel that they need to go outside of the relationship to have it, then they're going to be on that fence because they're going to want both relationships at the same time. And that doesn't necessarily make them bad people, but that could be because of, you know, life experiences, modeling in what they saw at home with their parents, trauma in their life, could be all sorts of things. And that's why it's really important to, it's just important to really know what you're talking about before, you know, before you act one way or the other.
Right. Agreed. And one thing I wanted to also just point out real quickly, it's kind of down another road here, but she mentioned something about, When I about moving out, and I don't know, it's kind of, I'm of the frame of mind that if I'm the hurt spouse, I'm not the one that's going to be moving out. I'm going to be making the other person move out. Now, you know, maybe there's some financial issues or other stuff there that's in play here that she can't do that. But I don't know. That's just kind of, I throw that out there that maybe, you know, she might want to reconsider that. But that's certainly up to her. I don't know if you have anything to add to that or not, but I just thought I'd throw that out.
Well, you know, again, I think that it's an individual decision, and it's not something that, you know, I don't think it's a decision that I should make for that person.
Right.
I think that, you know, in this case, she should make that decision. My only advice to her, you know, I don't know what the legal ramifications are if it ultimately leads to a separation and she moves out. You know, I know that sometimes it's come up that a lawyer has advised a spouse not to move out because then it's considered abandoning the children.
Sure.
And, you know, so before, again, just as I say, before making any decisions about what to do and how to do it, it's important to understand as much about the infidelity as possible as to where it's coming from and what the problem is that led to it. Similarly, if she wants to move out, that's her prerogative, but just be well advised by getting good counsel from a good lawyer.
Absolutely. Yeah. I always tell people to talk to that lawyer and get their financial and legal ducks in a row before they do anything like that, because you never know. You know, things start to get nasty, and some people don't think they're going to get nasty, and they inevitably do. So it's best to have good representation.
Know.
So, all right, real good. Let's move on to the next one here.
Sure.
I am the wife. My husband and I have been married almost 21 years. We are both in our young 40s. I had the affair for 18 months. It's confessed and over by approximately 6 weeks now, but my husband is insisting on keeping total tabs on me. I must call from the house phone before I leave for work. I must call him from the work phone when I get there. Repeat when I leave work. I can't go anywhere without him. I am under 24-hour watch. Is this healthy?
All right. Well, you know, checking up in this way, I would say, is not healthy on a long-term basis. But in this particular person's situation, she's saying she confessed over she confessed and it's over about 6 weeks. I don't see this behavior or these expectations by the husband as being unhealthy necessarily just 6 weeks into post-discovery.
Right.
You know, what the husband needs, sorry, what this woman needs is to, in my opinion, understand that her spouse has probably been traumatized by what she did. 6 weeks post-disclosure, I would say they're both probably still in crisis as a couple. And individual, and the goal in this early phase of recovery is to stabilize the couple and stabilize the situation. So the husband's reality or understanding of his life as he knew it has been shaken completely, and something like feeling like the floor he's standing on just disintegrated under his feet and he's in a free fall. So What he's trying to do, in my opinion, is probably trying to regain a sense of safety. And, you know, the way we do that is by being hypervigilant, which is not a totally expected reaction for a person who's being traumatized and wanting to feel safe again. So my advice to you know, the involved partner in this case is to try to find some compassion for her spouse and do what it takes to help him begin to stabilize and begin to recover, feel safe again. I also advise the hurt partner to get more educated about, you know, she could do this by going on the internet, searching, you know, using Google to search infidelity and how people react to infidelity and what to expect, or she could talk to people like yourself, Doug, who, you know, just to know what it's like for the hurt partner to discover that their spouse had been unfaithful. So in a nutshell, I would say that 6 weeks into it, I think this is what you get. I don't think it's unexpected. I don't think it's unhealthy. I think the, you know, this person's expectations may be a little unrealistic.
Right. I can't really disagree with anything you just said there. And the other thing is she doesn't mention whether or not she's even doing anything that would, you know, warrant him to trust her in any way either. You know, so we don't know what if anything she's doing. She may just be, you know, existing and not really being helpful or giving him any reason to trust her. So,
well, that's a good point. And I mean, I think the very fact that, like, if she is resistant to him wanting to, you know, her to make those phone calls, for example, and she's pushing back on that, you know, he's going to feel less safe and he's going to push harder. So, you know, I think it's really important to think about, you know, take some responsibility, you know, regardless of why it happened, why the affair happened, it's still the end result is that this person is traumatized and really not feeling very safe or secure. Her job right now is not to, in my opinion, ask whether it's healthy or not healthy. I think it's her job is, what can I do to help my spouse feel better? If she wants him to feel better.
Right. Very good. Okay. Next question here. Mm-hmm. 4 days ago, I found out about my wife's affair, and I have already made an appointment with a lawyer for divorce. Am I reacting too fast to the situation, or should I wait and see if we can recover from this?
Well, you know, 4 days ago, and in the previous question, we're talking about 6 weeks ago. So This it makes the other one sound like a long time ago, but you know, I often recommend that the hurt partner not rush into making any decisions when they're in crisis. And I think that that's a general rule of thumb of, you know, just life. You know, when you're in crisis or when you're feeling extremely emotional, don't make any decisions, especially long-term decisions that are going to affect your life. So, you know, in this case, I would say, why should this hurt partner not rush? Because I would think that after, you know, 4 days post-discovery, nobody would be thinking clearly. So more than likely, this, you know, this hurt partner is feeling, you know, overwhelmed with emotion. And, you know, I would suggest from a neurological perspective or, you know, or from a brain perspective, this person's limbic system, which is, you know, for people who don't know, the most primitive part of the brain, where the only responses that we have when we're sort of functioning from our limbic system is fight, flight, or freeze. So this person, you know, seeing a lawyer probably wants to take off or, you know, choose flight. But I would suggest that the person, you know, just sit tight for a little while. And I strongly recommend this person or anyone else in the situation, especially when there are kids, to slow down, avoid making any quick decisions that will affect their life and the lives of their kids forever, and instead focus on doing what they need to do to feel safe. And that may be, you know, connecting with someone like yourself, Doug, or connecting with someone like myself and getting some, you know, some help to figure out what they need to do to feel more safe. I also recommend that the that this person get individual, as I mentioned, support. It could also be a support group in the community, just to get help so that and not to feel alone. You know, it would also be especially important for this person to understand, you know, their motivation or his motivation in this case for wanting to end the marriage, so, you know, he can be sure that he's making the right decision. So basically I'm saying slow down, take a little bit of time to figure it out. And in general, in my practice, I speak to people about giving the situation a period of 4 to 6 months before making any final decisions to separate. And, you know, just on the side note, in the case of sex addicts, when I'm working with sex addicts, I usually ask people to not make any final decision about their situation, their relationship, what they want to do for about a year so that they could do some good recovery work and then make a decision from there. So, yeah, time and using time effectively, I think, would be the answer there.
Yeah. Well, and one thing, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but he says here, or should I wait and see if we can recover from this? Well, you know, it takes a little bit more than just waiting. You know, you got to be able to give it a try, for Pete's sakes. I guess it might make sense to at least try and do the work, you know, commit to it for a certain period of time. And if there's some progress and things start to work out, great. And if not, then I guess there's some tough decisions that need to be made. But, you know, after 4 days ready to, you know, file for divorce, that certainly seems like jumping the gun to me.
Yeah, like the other thing, I agree. And what's not clear in the question is, like when you read it initially, you say, well, this person made an appointment with a divorce lawyer to divorce and to proceed, you know, to initiate proceedings. On the other hand, when I think about the question now, I'm thinking, well, is he also, did he meet with a divorce lawyer to get information about his rights and what he would be,
true,
you know, what would be available to him or what could happen if he filed for divorce. And in that regard, I don't have a problem with seeing the divorce lawyer because that information could be very helpful in their deciding on what their boundaries are going to be and the consequences of those boundaries. So it really depends on what is, you know, what the purpose was for contacting the lawyer.
Yeah, good point. Okay, let's go on. I found out about my husband's affair 4 months ago after someone told me of his latest one. We are in counseling and wish to work things out, but I am haunted by questions of the details of the previous affairs. My counselor says the details are not going to help me and to focus on going forward. Is this really being completely honest enough for me to move on? I'm so untrusting now and feel haunted by all of my unanswered questions, like who they were, how many, when, and where.
That's incredible. You know, and I just want to preface what I say by, you know, I don't think on the surface, I don't think getting advice, you know, from a counselor saying that those questions or the details are not going to help her, help the person and to focus on moving forward, you know, certainly that kind of advice I would question.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, I'm concerned that maybe what's written in the question is a little out of context or we don't have all of the information. So I just want to, you know, put a proviso on that or just comment,
right.
You know, because we don't know exactly what went on in the therapy room. So, but on the other hand, I would say in general, if the hurt partner is not comfortable with the advice that they're getting, they should find another therapist who they are comfortable with. You know, so, and in doing that, you know, before I say that, I think that you know, there's not just one therapist and nobody is stuck with staying in a situation or working with somebody they don't feel comfortable with or they don't trust. So if that's the case, you know, this is a very important situation for this person and they should do whatever they need to do in order to get the help that's going to be, you know, most helpful and from the person that's going to be able to deliver it in a way that's
right.
Helpful. In finding a therapist, I always encourage people to interview the therapist and make sure that they're experienced in working with infidelity and that the therapist is in fact on the same page as the hurt partner. So, you know, I'm often contacted by people who ask me questions, and I'm very, very happy when I get people asking me questions about my perspective, my, you know, professional background, my experience in working with infidelity, my own personal biases about infidelity. And, you know, these are really, really important questions. So I would encourage this person to consider that if they're not happy with what they're getting. I certainly don't agree with that, with giving blanket advice such as what this person wrote. I feel, and I tell all the people that I work with, that the hurt partner needs to determine what information they need in order to move on and what information they don't need in order to move on. And where a therapist can be very helpful would be helping that person sort of process, if they're asking a particular question, why is that important to that person, and how will that help them in their recovery process? And then from that discussion, the person can go forward and talk, decide whether to ask the question or not. I certainly cannot think of a situation where the hurt partner needs zero information, such as is suggested in this question in this email, and furthermore, a lack of critical information can hinder or affect the recovery process. So, you know, as I said, I think the therapist could be very, very helpful in figuring out which questions to ask. To be told by a therapist not to ask questions about the affair seems to, you know, in my opinion anyway, be a situation where the counselor is unintentionally encouraging the secrecy and mistrust that began in the affair to continue in the coupleship, which is a fundamental problem after infidelity. So no wonder this person continues to feel untrusting and scared.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, despite what the counselor is saying that, you know, the details aren't going to help, you know, the more critical reality is that not getting the answers to those questions about details, whatever it is she wants to know, you know, I think it's going to hurt more than anything else, and that's going to make it, you know, far less likely that they can, you know, recover and rebuild the relationship.
Well, there are certain questions that, you know, I don't think need to be asked.
Sure, absolutely.
Because the more information you have, you know, sometimes it's more difficult to get sort of an image out of your head. So if, you know, a lot of people come into my office and they say, well, you know, I want to ask about, you know, what they did together physically. And I say, well, you know, are you really sure that's going to be helpful in the recovery process? Because if you know that, how is it going to be helpful? And generally speaking, I think most people in the field would say that's information you don't need. And the fear there, of course, is that you're always going to have it in your head, and it's going to be really, really difficult to get it out of your head. But just in general, any question you may ask, you know, do you really want to know that, or are you just being curious? And is it really going to help you? Because once you have information in your head, you can't get it out. So, you know, so it really is an important issue to consider. But not to be told by a therapist or anybody, you know, you don't need to ask that question, and don't, and just move on to the future. Because as I said, you know, infidelity is built on a foundation of secrecy and mistrust. And you don't want to perpetuate that in the recovery process. So, that's how I see it.
Let's take that scenario that you just mentioned about, you know, someone wanting to ask questions about the, you know, the sexual details and things like that. And let's say for a minute that they did not have the benefit of speaking to you first, and they go ahead and bring up that question to their unfaithful spouse. How should the unfaithful spouse react to that? I mean, they don't want to answer the question. What can they say to that person that, you know, like a script, if you will, that would be a safe and proper thing to say?
Well, I would I would ask, I would encourage the involved partner to do very much the same that I would do in the office, and that is say, you know, the only difference would be that the involved partner might say something like, listen, you know, I'm prepared to answer whatever question you need me to answer, and that will be helpful to you, but please, first of all, be sure that that's information you want to know and that it will be helpful to you. So you're just not jumping in and answering the question immediately. Mm-hmm. You're asking the hurt partner to think it through. And but it's really important to add the part where you're saying, I'm not hiding anything and I'm willing to answer any questions you have. Because if you leave that part out, then there's a very good chance the hurt partner is going to think they're just protecting the affair partner, or just not, you know, just wanting to keep that information from them.
Right. And if in the heat of the conversation, then if the hurt partner says, yes, I need to know this, I mean, should he go ahead or she go ahead and tell? Should the involved partner go ahead and tell them then, or should they say, well, maybe you better think about it overnight? I mean, what would you recommend?
Yeah, like I would prefer that the person not give that information, because that kind of graphic information will never, well, I shouldn't say never, but will stay in the hurt partner's head and memory for a long time. And if they are rebuilding the relationship, you know, then that becomes problematic in the bedroom, or could become problematic in the bedroom. But I would say there's other ways to get around it, in the sense of, if the hurt partner is in individual therapy, I might encourage or ask my spouse, you know, could, before we go there, could you please talk about that with your therapist in the next session, see what he or she says, and stuff, you know, things like that.
Okay, great. All right, very good. All right, last question. I recently found out my wife of 15 years had several affairs. I have forgiven her, but she is having trouble dealing with the guilt. What should she do? That's a big question for you.
Yeah, well, they all are. But, yeah. You know, I often distinguish between healthy guilt and unhealthy guilt. And I say that while healthy guilt felt by the involved partner is not necessarily a bad thing, and furthermore, it's even appropriate after having an affair, if it goes on for a long time and becomes an obstacle to the recovery process, you know, either for the individual or the couple, I would recommend, again, that the person get help to process that guilt with someone who is experienced and can help them with that. However, on the other hand, given that this woman has had several affairs, it raises a concern for me about what is going on for her and why is she doing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it also raises the question of why is her spouse staying with her, but we'll leave mm-hmm. that for now.
Okay.
But just when you know, in thinking about the involved partner, for this reason alone, for her sake and for the best interest of the marriage, I personally would encourage this woman to seek therapy so she can understand why, as I said, she continues to seek other relationships and affairs. You know, what I'm really thinking about, to be totally honest with you, is either love addiction or sex addiction. And, you know, there are three categories, for example, as to why people are unfaithful. And it's important to understand what category the acting out or affair behavior falls into, because then you know what you're treating. You know, mm-hmm. you just cannot treat every affair, every betrayal the same way. You know, there's just different things you target, different things you focus on when you're, at least when I'm working with people after infidelity. So You know, those three categories are either sex addiction, characterological, or a bad relationship. And you see, there's only the relationship part is only one of those three. So sex addiction is obviously huge. And in this case, when a person is dealing with multiple affairs, I would want to rule that out before continuing. Characterological, what we look for there primarily is either immaturity or narcissism or both, and a bad relationship. And you know, when I break it down that way, it really speaks to something here, because you know, it was a while back, several years ago, that I heard not all affairs are a result of bad marriages. And in fact, there's a statistic that I came across that says 35% of the people who have affairs would describe their marriage as good. So that begs the question of why do people have affairs? Or right. Why else do people have affairs? And those other two categories would certainly help explain that. So it's important to understand in this particular case, but certainly in answering this question, it's really important to understand and then resolve why this woman continues to be unfaithful multiple times. What is behind that? Because if you don't find out the etiology or the why it's happening, then there's probably a really good chance it's going to happen again.
Right. So what if we take that particular variable out of this question, where you know it was just a one-time
thing?
It was a one-time affair versus multiple affairs, and she's still feeling guilt. I was just talking to somebody this morning, actually, whose spouse had one affair, just lasted really just a couple of times, and she's struggling extremely. An extreme amount from the guilt that she suffers from what she's done. So let's take the multiple affairs out of the equation and you know, what does a person do if they're just racked with guilt and can't seem to move forward?
Well, first of all, I want to know if it's guilt or shame. But at the end of the day, I mean, that person, in my opinion, would do well for him or herself to meet with somebody, you know, a few times or as long as necessary, to really talk about where that guilt is coming from, and why they aren't able to let it go and move on. So I think it's really a lot about introspection and understanding himself and where it's coming from and why they aren't able to move past it.
Yeah. And also just, you know, what have they learned from this whole experience to where they could take that knowledge and, you know, become a better person and change in a way that, you know, will make a difference down the line, I think, as well. And one thing I'm wondering, too, is that does it help a person usually in a situation knowing that their hurt spouse has forgiven them? Does that help them at all, do you think? Or,
well,
catalyst?
Again, it's case by case, you know, because,
sure.
You know, there's a lady that I'm working with right now who's, she had a quite long affair, and she told her husband about it, and he does forgive her, but she doesn't feel that it's warranted. So even though there's the forgiveness by the spouse, the hurt spouse, it's not working for her. So, you know, again, one has to wonder, what is it about this person's personality that she's not able there? You know, when a person is not able to get past their guilt. What is it about their life experiences? What does it, you know, is there a religious component? Who knows? Like, every case is a case-by-case basis. But I just want to say, you know, before I forget, that there's, in my opinion, there's healthy guilt and unhealthy guilt. And, you know, healthy guilt, you know, we all feel healthy guilt, you know, and that is
sure.
when we do something wrong and we feel guilty about it, it stops us from doing it again, or it can, you know, hopefully. But it's the toxic guilt that you want to deal with. And that, you know, I don't think someone's going to, you know, clearly from this example, you know, forgiveness doesn't just doesn't solve that problem. That person
gotcha.
Needs to do some individual work.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, David, those are great answers to some tough questions. So appreciate you the time that you spent with us today to answer all that. It's some good stuff. So
again, my pleasure.
Appreciate it so much. So maybe we can do this again sometime. So anyhow, David, thank you again. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
You as well, Doug. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
All right.